Good evening, and thank you for joining us for tonight's teleconference, a special members-only briefing on the human rights crisis happening right now at the hands of the Myanmar military. Please allow me to introduce our speakers, Joanne Lin, Matt Wells, and Francisco Bencosme. Joanne Lin is the National Director of Advocacy and Government Relations at Amnesty International USA. As National Director of Advocacy and Government Relations, Joanne supervises a team of advocacy directors who work with Congress and the U.S. government to protect refugees and human rights defenders worldwide. Prior to joining Amnesty, Joanne directed the Federal Immigration Policy Advocacy Program at the American Civil Liberties Union for a decade. Matt Wells is Senior Crisis Advisor at Amnesty International. Matt has more than a decade of experience carrying out human rights investigations across Africa and Asia, with a particular focus on mass atrocity crimes, including those in the Philippines, South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Cote d'Ivoire. As Senior Crisis Advisor at Amnesty International, he undertakes human rights investigations in situations of armed conflict and major crisis. Over the last year, he has undertaken 5 research missions to Myanmar and Bangladesh. Francisco Bencosme is the Asia-Pacific Advocacy Manager at Amnesty. Francisco recently left his post as a legislative assistant on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where he worked on U.S. foreign policy in the East Asia, Pacific, and South Asia regions. He has been a principal drafter and negotiator of the Burman Human Rights and Freedom Act, the legislation that Amnesty is actively lobbying for. As Asia-Pacific Advocacy Manager at Amnesty International USA, he currently helps develop strategies to influence U.S. policy towards bringing about improvements in the human rights in the Asia-Pacific area. Joanne, Matt, and Francisco will walk us through the human rights situation in Myanmar, Amnesty's response to this ongoing crisis, and what you can do to help. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. A brief question-and-answer session will follow the formal presentation. If anyone should require operator assistance or technical support during the conference, please press *0 on your telephone keypad. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Joanne, Matt, and Francisco. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, Caroline, for that introduction. Good evening, everyone. My name is Joanne Lin, and I'm calling in from Washington, D.C., where I have the privilege of working with a team of advocacy directors and researchers who are fighting each day to protect refugees and promote human rights worldwide. I'm so pleased and honored to be joining tonight's conversation, especially with my colleagues Francisco Bencosme, Amnesty USA's Advocacy Manager for Asia, and with Matt Wells, Amnesty's Senior Crisis Response Advisor, who is joining us from Myanmar, where he's presently on the ground researching and interviewing Rohingya refugees and conducting additional investigations and research. Before we get started, I first want to thank all of you, our donors and our supporters. Because of your support, Amnesty has been able to bring to bear all of our research, advocacy, and campaigning tools to educate the world and world leaders on the Myanmar military's atrocities against the Rohingya. The Rohingya Muslims are a religious minority who have lived in Myanmar for generations and have long been persecuted by Myanmar authorities. In August 2017, this persecution and violence reached new levels as Myanmar security forces unleashed a systematic ethnic cleansing campaign against the Rohingya. Security forces went from one Rohingya village to the next in northern Rakhine State, summarily executing men, mass raping women and girls, setting whole villages on fire, killing babies. Those Rohingya who managed to escape walked days, sometimes weeks, to flee into neighboring Bangladesh. Over 700,000 Rohingya have poured into Bangladesh since August. This is roughly the population of Washington, D.C. What we are witnessing is 21st century ethnic cleansing and crimes against humanity being committed en masse before the entire world. Amnesty International, with your support, is committed to doing everything within our power and resources to protect the Rohingya and to press Myanmar to halt the atrocities being, being committed against the Rohingya and other religious and ethnic minorities. We are so fortunate to have Matt Wells joining us tonight from Myanmar. He is literally on the ground doing research, investigations, and documentation of this ongoing human rights crisis. And after Matt speaks, we will be joined by Francisco Bencosme, who will update us on what's underway in Congress and the Trump administration to halt these atrocities. Francisco will also tell us about a brand new amnesty campaign launched today to release two Reuters journalists who have been imprisoned by Myanmar authorities for reporting on the crimes being committed against the Rohingya. I'll turn it over to Matt now. Matt?
Thank you, Joanne. And yes, thank you everyone for joining. As Joanne said, I've been part of the team that has led our research and investigations on the crisis for the last 9 months. I'm part of what is called the Crisis Response Team at Amnesty, focusing on areas of armed conflict and major crisis. And one of the reasons why Amnesty has put this team together is so that we can respond rapidly to situations like this. And so within a week of the outbreak of this violence on the 25th of August, members of our team were on the ground in Bangladesh as people were arriving to get a sense of exactly what was happening that was forcing people to flee. I myself first went to Bangladesh in the middle of September to do about 2 weeks of investigation at that time. And there were still every day just a mass of people that were crossing the border. I'd go down to the boat arrival point where, you know, we'd see dozens of boats packed with 50, 60 men, women, and children arriving after fleeing their villages, as Joanne said, often a week before. They'd walk for days in Myanmar to get to a point where they could then take a boat to get to Bangladesh. Or we'd go further up north where people were crossing by land through paddy fields. It was a heavy part of the rainy season in Myanmar and Bangladesh. And so people would be walking and waiting for days through water in order to cross into Bangladesh. And as Joanne said, you know, one of the things that really sticks out about this particular crisis is the consistency of stories that I heard across a huge geographic area in Myanmar. Again and again, people would talk about how the Myanmar military had arrived in their village, that they had run out from their homes, and that as they were running, as they were trying to get away, the military had opened fire on them from behind, without any sort of discrimination, and as Joanne said, killing what we now know to be thousands of men, women, and children. MSF has put together probably the best quantitative work so far, and their conservative estimate is that in the first month of the crisis alone, at least 6,700 people were killed, including 730 children under the age of five. It has been a truly horrific campaign in which the military has targeted virtually every Rohingya man, woman, and child. There are so many stories I could tell from the interviews I've done. At this stage, we've done, you know, close to 350 one-on-one interviews in Bangladesh, and now after this week, another 50 to 60 on this side of the border in Myanmar. But one in particular that I think will always stand with me is of a 12-year-old girl whose name was Fatima, is Fatima. I met with her about a week after she had arrived in Bangladesh from a village called Chutpien in Myanmar, where one of the three largest massacres took place. She told me that she was at home that day with her mother and father and brothers and sisters. She had seven siblings. And as the military entered the village, they saw that there were homes being burned in another part of the village. And so she ran out of her house with her family. As they ran outside, she was less than 20 meters from her house running away when soldiers opened fire on them from behind. She saw as her father was shot and killed. He fell down next to her as they were running together. Her younger sister was also shot and killed. And then she was likewise hit by a bullet in her thigh. And when I spoke with her several weeks after this, she showed me the wounds in her thigh that had never really been able to get treatment because they had been on the run then for a week to get to Bangladesh. Fortunately, a neighbor had seen when she was shot and picked her up and carried her to safety to a neighboring hill where they hunkered down for days until the military had finished systematically burning their village. We know now that more than 350 villages in northern Rakhine State were either totally or partially burned by the Myanmar military. In addition to her father and her younger sister, her mother and brother were also killed. And so when I interviewed her in the refugee camp in Bangladesh, she at 12 was now the oldest living member of her family. She was holding her 5-month-old brother as she was now essentially responsible for her younger siblings. And it's one of many such stories that I could tell in that, again, as Joanne laid out so well, that this is something that was done again and again in villages across North Rakhine State. The military, there is no doubt that what the military was trying to do amounts to ethnic cleansing, and that they were trying to purge that entire part of the country of its Rohingya population. After that initial work, in which, you know, our focus was really on trying to break events as they were happening in the first month. In addition to documenting the burning, we broke stories on the fact that the Myanmar military had laid landmines on paths that people were using to flee to Bangladesh. So to add further injury to a horrific campaign, they were mining areas that people were using to escape. And there have been several dozen people who stepped on landmines while trying to flee. We then went back. I went back in January as part of a team in which the goal was to go very deep on the specific units and individuals responsible for a lot of this. And what we've tried to do is focus deep on specific villages. So there are many villages from which we have interviewed now 20 or 30 people from the same village, so that we can present a really airtight case of exactly what happened and of the units and people that were responsible. And we've combined all of those interviews with really new technologies to deepen human rights investigations. So we have relied heavily on satellite imagery. We have an expert as part of our team who works solely on remote sensing, on looking at satellite imagery with which we can corroborate what we're hearing from testimonies. As I said, we're now at over 350 villages that have been burned, and the satellite imagery has really made it impossible for the Myanmar government and the Myanmar military in any way credibly deny the scale of what took place and the nature of the burning itself. We can see from the imagery just how systematic this campaign has been to burn every last home, every last mosque, every last market in these villages where, as Joanne said, people have lived for generations. We've also acquired a huge amount of photographic and video material, and we have experts on staff who can authenticate photos and videos as having been taken at the time and place that people suggest. And that then allows us to use that material as further evidence. And so what we've ultimately been able to do, with testimonies, with satellite imagery, with photo and video material, is to triangulate, to corroborate what has happened, and to make it all the more compelling for diplomats and others to show that there really is no doubt about what happened in these villages, and again, who within the Myanmar military is responsible. And the other thing is that we have persisted in trying to get access to the site of what happened itself. And in the last 2 weeks, we have been the first human rights group to get to Rakhine State to focus on what happened during the period last year since the outbreak of the violence. And so we have now been able to couple the interviews on the Bangladesh side of the border with dozens of interviews on the Myanmar side of the border. And with that, in the next month, month and a half, we will be putting out our most comprehensive report to date. And that report will identify a number of specific individuals within the military who are responsible for the crimes against humanity that have happened. And that will be part of a big push for accountability. What we know in Myanmar is that the military has operated above the law for decades. And that has, along with the kind of systematic racism and oppression of the Rohingya, has led to the situation in which the military feels it can get away with these sorts of horrific crimes. And so the key now is using the power of the amnesty movement to push around the world for accountability for the atrocities that have been committed. And throughout the crisis and going forward, we in the research team have had the pleasure of working so closely with AIUSA in getting the bill before the House and the Senate pushed through committees so that we can ultimately get it towards a vote, and in pushing the administration and State Departments to hold people responsible for the crimes that have been committed. We certainly still have a very long way to go. The situation remains dire for, as Joanne said, the almost 700,000 who have been forced into Bangladesh. But I think over the last 9 months, what we have seen is that we have been able to very much shift the narrative around what happened to force people to take notice of the nature of what the Myanmar military has done, and to start the groundwork then for the accountability that's needed to make sure that these sorts of crimes aren't committed again. And I'll pass to Francisco there.
Thank you, Matt. And that was really a great comprehensive view of what's going on the ground. I just want to say on sort of the outset that as a former Senate staffer and key drafter of the Burma Human Rights and Freedom Act, I saw firsthand how the work that Amnesty did on Myanmar impacted the work that I was doing for a policymaker. And we can kind of go into a couple examples. But first is, as Matt mentioned, in terms of legislation, when the Senate and the House were working on S-2060 and H.R. 4223, Amnesty's research directly fed into the congressional findings, policy recommendations, and stories to compel members to action. Then we actually, as Amnesty USA, did direct in-person lobbying. As you might have all heard, on February 25th and 26th, Amnesty International USA undertook its first major grassroots lobby day, what is known as the National Lobby Day. This came right after our 2018 annual general membership. We had 281 volunteer who participated and who lobbied one or more congressional offices, and we had four legislative priorities as an organization that were related to the Myanmar Rohingya crisis. Some of you might be asking what our impact has been, and I'll talk a little bit about what those different legislative priorities were during our National Lobby Day. First is H.R. 4223, the Burma Act of 2018. This legislation, similar to the Senate legislation, authorizes humanitarian assistance to be provided to the Myanmar Rohingya refugee crisis, both in Bangladesh, in Burma, and throughout the region. It also forces the United States to hold senior military officials accountable for their actions in the crisis. H.R. 4223 has 25 new representatives who have co-sponsored since Amnesty National Lobby Day. 11 of them received Amnesty members' visits and direct lobbying, and it has a total of 52 members. We have also been very closely working with the House Foreign Affairs Committee staff in helping them negotiate and do additional research to the text of the bill, which we have seen positive signs for a markup coming soon. On the Senate side, S26E, which is the Burma Human Rights and Freedom Act, has a total of 20 new co-sponsors. It cleared an important hurdle by having a unanimous consent from the Democrats. And S2060 is very similar to the House bill in that it authorizes humanitarian assistance and has important accountability measures on key senior military officials. We were also lobbying for SRES 376, which is a resolution calling for the repatriation through safe, dignified, and voluntary return of the Rohingya back to Myanmar. It picked up three additional new co-sponsors after our Amnesty National Lobby Day and passed the Senate Foreign Relations Committee unanimously. It's also important to note that even if the bills haven't become law, the strong bipartisan signal that they send are still important and significant and are still important to sort of have the United States, particularly the State Department and the White House, to take action on the Myanmar crisis. For example, on April 23rd, the State Department announced an allocation of additional $50 million in humanitarian aid for the Rohingya crisis. This brings a total of U.S. aid to Bangladesh and Myanmar to more than $163 million since August 2017. In announcing the aid, the Acting Secretary of State cited strong bipartisan support for the reason why they were taking the action, which is a direct reason for why all of Amnesty's national lobbying signaled to the State Department that they have the backing of Congress to really make a significant increase in humanitarian assistance. As part of our ongoing advocacy, we've briefed senior levels of the State Department, of USAID, of the U.S. Mission to United Nations, the National Security Council, including the Vice President's Office, Senate and House key offices, and the Congressional Research Service. To give you an example of the impact that some of that direct lobbying has also had to the administration, recently, USAID Administrator Green on April 26, in front of the House Appropriations Subcommittee that funds international development assistance, cited that his meeting with Amnesty International, alongside with other meetings that he had, has directly impacted his preparation for his trip to Myanmar. He will be visiting Myanmar from May 13th to May 20th and represents the highest level U.S. official visit in 2018. We also briefed two important congressional staff delegations that were headed to Bangladesh and Burma, and one senior-level congressional staffer even emailed Amnesty and said, "Satellite imagery was raised in quite a few of our conversations during the trip. I'm glad I was able to be briefed by you all beforehand. It was enormously helpful." And as Joanne mentioned in her remarks, for the month of May, Amnesty USA is launching a Human Rights Defender campaign campaigning for the Myanmar Reuters journalists, which will be our top campaign for the month of May. As you all know, the Reuters journalists were arrested for uncovering mass atrocities in Indian and Rakhine State. They face potentially up to 14 years in prison and possibly are essentially being called human rights defenders for uncovering human rights abuses that were going on in Rakhine State for a law that it's clearly vague and is used to imprison things like journalists. We've worked with Senator Durbin's office to send a letter of solidarity for World Press Freedom Day, which is actually tomorrow. We helped them draft the letter, and we have a total of five senators signed on to the letter. For World Press Freedom Day, we've also had several members of Congress in both the House and Senate commit to using social media to press for their unconditional and immediate release. We've worked in coalition with other NGOs to help arrange meetings with the family of the Reuters journalists that we'll be visiting later this month. And we have a full rollout of press, digital, and direct lobbying with various stakeholders in the DC community to help continue the drumbeat on calling for the release of these prisoners. So stay tuned for a really engaged Human Rights Defenders campaign to calling for the release of these Reuters journalists. And maybe I can turn a little bit to how all of you on the call can take action, particularly as Amnesty USA focuses on the Human Rights Defenders campaign. We have created, we call on all of you to go online to www.amnestyusa.org /FreeReuters/, and in it you'll see that it gives our members an opportunity to take action. For example, in 30 seconds, you can sign a petition that will be sent to the ambassador from Myanmar to the United States. If you have 2 minutes, you can make an easy call to Myanmar's embassy in D.C. The phone number for that is 1-877-861-6751. If you have 5 minutes, you can ask your senator to demand for their release. And you can also help us spread the word. Tomorrow, for example, is World Press Freedom Day, and you can share that page that I repeated on Twitter or Facebook, and make sure to use the hashtag #FreeWalone and #KosOO and tag us at Amnesty USA. And then if you want to do any more, feel free to email Emily at hrd@aiusa.org for more opportunities. So for the month of May, we really are counting for a full campaign on these human rights defenders, Myanmar Reuters journalists, and we call on all of our members to join us. Thank you, and I'll turn it over to Joanne.
Thank you so much, Matt and Francisco. Operator, we are ready to open up the lines for questions from our callers.
At this time, we will be conducting a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star key. Our first question is with Larry Spears. Please proceed with your question.
A question about any activity with regard to the International Criminal Court.
Matt, can you take that question?
Yes, happy to. So there are a couple of developments that are happening. So the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Court has, or I should start by prefacing to say Myanmar is, as will not surprise any of you, not a state party to the Rome Statute. So there's not, jurisdiction in that way. There is also, unfortunately, not a high likelihood of a UN Security Council referral to the ICC because Myanmar is being protected on the Security Council by China and, to a lesser extent, Russia. And so there's almost no way that they will not block any effort in the Security Council to refer the case to the ICC. So in part because of that, the Office of the Prosecutor at the ICC has put forward a fairly innovative legal idea in order to try to get jurisdiction. So Bangladesh is a state party to the Rome Statute. And what the prosecutor has argued and has filed right now, and the judges will be making a ruling at some point, is that because close to 700,000 Rohingya have been forced into Bangladesh, that it amounts to the crime against humanity of forcible transfer, forcible deportation. There's no doubt it does meet the threshold of that crime against humanity. But what she has argued is that because there is a nexus to Bangladesh in the crime and that people are being forced there, that the court should be able to have jurisdiction over that crime itself. Whether this will succeed is unclear. It's a fairly new legal idea. I think there is a chance that it will succeed, but it's not something that we can or should put all of our hopes in. Also because even if it were to succeed, it would mean that the prosecutor's office would only be able to investigate and prosecute the crime of forcible transfer. Now, you could get a lot that would fall within that because the killings, the rapes, the burning of villages has been, as we've talked about, part of an ethnic cleansing campaign. But ultimately, you would not be able to prosecute senior military officials for murder, for rape, for other crimes that have been committed. It would solely be on this issue of forcible transfer. So, we are pushing, and we will actually launch next week. There will be a joint press conference in New York with Human Rights Watch and Fortify Rights to push for an ICC referral. Again, we know it's challenging, but we want to start mobilizing around the fact that no matter how challenging it may be, that this needs to be something that countries like the U.S., countries like the U.K., France need to put forward. They need to force China and Russia to actually veto, as opposed to being afraid of a veto and so not beginning the process in the first place. And the other thing that we are really pushing for right now is even if we can't get an ICC referral today, or even if we can't get any sort of specific justice mechanism right now, that the process for criminal investigations has to start now. We have to start seeing the preservation of evidence and more, criminal investigative efforts to start identifying individuals and others to be prosecuted down the road, so that, if and when the dynamics change, as they frequently do, whether it be a year from now or 5 years from now, that the investigative work will have already been done, such that we can then, seize the moment and begin prosecutions as quickly as possible, again, kind of if and when geopolitics change on some of this.
Thank you, Matt. We're ready for the next question.
Our next question is with Courtney Kasdan. Please proceed with your question.
How do you assess the role for good or for bad of Aung San Suu Kyi?
Oh, that's a tough question. Matt, I'm going to turn that one over to you again.
Sure. It's a really difficult question. Obviously, she is someone that was held up by the human rights community and by Amnesty International specifically for a very long time as a human rights defender, as a ambassador of conscience. She's a Nobel Peace Prize winner. I think we're all incredibly disappointed, and I think there are a couple of specific things to say. First is that she doesn't exercise control over the Myanmar military. That the military oversees its operations. That the Ministry of Defense, the Ministry of Home Affairs, like these are all controlled by the military, and the military controls its own investigative and judicial processes. So there's no civilian oversight over their ability to investigate themselves for the crimes. And so that's, again, for decades led to the military to operate almost completely above the law, because they investigate themselves, they judge themselves, and that has worked in ways that are entirely predictable. And so she cannot control, the military directly, but she has failed in moral leadership. Not only has she and her office not spoken out against what has happened, what is happening, but at times her spokesperson and others around her have actually, said things that are themselves incitements that, claim that the Rohingya do not belong in the country, are not part of the fabric of Myanmar society, that have excused what the military has done, that have denied any sort of abuses. I mean, the most appalling thing that has come out of the office is they say that no one would rape a Rohingya woman, in saying in derogatory ways why that sort of allegation couldn't be credible, that no soldier would ever want to do that. I mean, they have at times said really appalling things in the face of overwhelming evidence from organizations like our own and others as to just what has happened. And beyond that, and this goes back to, what Francisco and Joanna both talked about with the Reuters journalist, but the civilian governments led by Aung San Suu Kyi has also, taken very problematic actions. They have been part of the effort to deny humanitarian access in Northern Rakhine State, which has made for months it harder for aid to reach people who desperately need it. They have been part of the crackdown on journalists and free expression more generally. The law that's been used to prosecute the two Reuters journalists dates from the 1920s, prior to the country's independence. It's a colonial law that her party could pass legislation to get rid of those sorts of antiquated laws that are being used to target journalists and target activists more generally, and they have chosen not to. It has been incredibly disappointing, both in terms of her lack of statements about what's happened and in some of the actions, on the margins that have affected humanitarian access and the ability of a press and human rights defenders to report on what's taken place.
I hope you're continuing to document exactly those actions.
Yes, we are. We definitely are. And as I said, we will have a very big report coming out in about a month and a half that will go much further than we even have so far.
Thank you. We're ready for the next question.
Our next question is with Kelly Marlett. Please proceed with your question.
Hey, so we were hearing that Matt said that we have gained reentry into Rakhine State. We're wondering when Amnesty International regained entry into Myanmar as a country as a whole. And I'm Kayla Parker. I'm out in Denver, Colorado.
Thank you, Kayla. Matt?
I actually don't know the exact date when we got reentry to the country. I mean, it's been a while at this stage. At first it was quieter and kind of for very discreet missions. I mean, I know, even a decade ago, we had the ability to come in at times to do discreet research projects. But it was often limited in where we could get to within the country. I should say on Rakhine State, we had authorization from state level authorities. We did not have authorization from national level authorities. We have been seeking to get to Northern Rakhine State for months, and the national authorities, we have written again and again to Aung San Suu Kyi's office, and they have never given authorization. We ultimately then went to the state level authorities, and they said okay, and that was enough for us to get on the ground. But there still continues to be blocks from the national authorities in terms of where they are okay with us getting to. And even for this mission, there are parts of Northern Rakhine State that we that remained off limits to us. They will not let anyone credible into the specific areas where the worst of the atrocities took place. And so what we had to do was get a bit creative, and we organized people to come out from all of those areas into a more secure location elsewhere where we could interview people. But we still can't get to the villages where these crimes occurred.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question is with Gail Bunker. Please proceed with your question.
Yes, I wanted to know about the repatriation idea, when it sounds like from the atrocities, these people will never be safe to return. And also if you could comment on the state of the Bangladesh camps. Thank you.
Okay, Matt.
Sure. It's a great question. And I mean, I think you're absolutely right that the idea of repatriation right now is it's laughable, to be frank. Abuses are still ongoing. When I was most recently in Bangladesh, you still had people crossing from Myanmar to Bangladesh. They were being driven by the threat of starvation because of deliberate acts that the military was taking. So the military has burned down markets or cut off access to other markets. It has blocked people from going out to their rice fields to harvest rice during the harvest season in November and December last year. And so basically people were no longer able to feed themselves. And so we're being forced into Bangladesh as a result. And so, you know, far from you know, being ready to begin repatriation, they are still actively pushing people out of the country through their actions, even if in, you know, quieter ways than the most acute violence in the first weeks. And so, you know, repatriation needs to be thought of as a you know, medium-term goal. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen in the coming months. There's no way for it to be, you know, safe and voluntary, dignified at this stage. But I don't think we should, you know, feel that it will never be possible. I think the key here is that we need to work towards making the situation in Rakhine such that returns could be possible. And that involves a couple of things. The first is addressing the impunity of the military. As long as the military operates in the way that it does now, you're absolutely right that the idea that the Rohingya could return to their villages with the same soldiers and police who had just burned down their homes and shot their, you know, husband or child, you know, it's ridiculous. But if you begin to address the military's impunity, then you could have a situation in which, you know, people would feel more able to return. And the second is dismantling the entire system of what we at Amnesty have called apartheid that exists. There's a whole, you know, system of discrimination and persecution that's been in place for years that impacts the Rohingya population's ability to access education, to access healthcare, simply to move around from village to village. And so, you know, there needs to be the beginning of dismantling that architecture of apartheid and to recognize, you know, their right to citizenship. These are obviously big things that will take time, but that's where we have to focus our energy, is on addressing what are the root causes of what's taken place over the last 9 months. And once that begins, then we can really start to think about, you know, what's possible in terms of returns. You know, when I interview people in Bangladesh, no one is interested in returning now, but most people that I've interviewed do hold out hope to return someday. I mean, these are their homes. This is where they've lived for a really, really, really long time. And so most people are not, you know, they haven't come to a stage in which they don't give up hope to return at some point. They still do. And so I think we need to try to work towards creating a reality in which that is actually then possible. In terms of the situation in Bangladesh itself, I mean, it speaks to why people do, of course, still hope to return. The situation is dire. I mean, these are, you have, combined with previous waves of refugees, you have more than 800,000 Rohingya in this concentrated area of Bangladesh, in which, you know, they've, in order to build structures, virtually the entire vegetation of what used to be, you know, an area of forest has been chopped down. And they've built, you know, shelters into hills, and what that means is that the rains are about to come, and the threat for landslides is huge. The threat for flooding in a way that will impact people is enormous. And in addition, when that flooding happens, which it will, you know, because of how tightly concentrated people are, there have often been toilets built in very close proximity to wells for water. And so you're likely to have the flooding of latrines into drinking water. And the result, you know, humanitarians now are, you know, preparing for outbreaks of cholera and, you know, other diseases. The situation in the coming months is devastating, to be blunt. And it's why, you know, it has been encouraging and helpful that the U.S. administration has been, you know, pushed to give more money, and that there has been more humanitarian assistance funding provided by the administration. And we need to ensure that sort of support continues, because going back to your original question, you know, this isn't likely to end, you know, in the next couple months. And so we need to see sustained engagement. This can't be a population that, 2 months from now, 6 months from now is forgotten. Funding dries up, and then we see, an already bad situation get much, much worse.
Thanks, Matt. Our next call?
Our next question is with Topher Kusa. Please proceed with your question.
Yes, please. I had been from Nigeria and Africa. I've had a lot over time in the news with the Rwandan population and the atrocities, the civil atrocities against human rights committed in Rwanda. It's kind of deeply saddening to know that these things are still going on today in this context. And I had one thing that was brought up earlier in the discussion was the concept of diplomatic immunity for the military regime, high-standing officers in the military regime. How is it possible that we are contemplating something like diplomatic immunity for high-standing officers in that regime, when even people like Saddam were brought to justice in the Iraq era? That's one question. Then the second thing I wanted to quickly touch on was the concept of home. I noticed you said that a lot of the people who have fled from the Rohingya people who have fled to Bangladesh still want to come home. I think it's a recurring theme. This was the theme that I found out from Ukraine. My girlfriend happens to work at Amnesty, and she did some research in Ukraine, and she noted that one constant theme was they always wanted to come home. What do you think are the possible factors that are responsible for the people in the Rohingya people wanting to go back home, seeing all the calamity that befell them back home? Thank you very much.
Thank you for the question. I mean, it was a two-pronged question and far-ranging beyond the specific countries and refugee crisis that is the topic of today's call. Matt, I don't know if you want to address the second question at all, or Francisco, if you want to. I'll leave it to you to decide.
Sure. So on the first question real quick, I was talking about impunity. So there's not really discussion on the table from anyone on diplomatic immunity or immunity more generally, given the nature of the crimes. These rise to the level of international crimes quite clearly. We, as Joanne said at the outset, we have described them as crimes against humanity, as have others. I don't think there's any real doubt at this stage that they easily reach that threshold of crimes against humanity. And so, under international law, there can be no immunity from crimes of that nature. Whether it's before the International Criminal Court or another body someday in the future, each of the senior ranking military against whom there is enough evidence compiled will have to answer for their crimes. They will have no ability to argue any sort of immunity from responsibility, given the nature of what's happened. And we will, certainly if there's ever an effort down the road, as there often is in situations like this, to push for an amnesty or anything else that would excuse accountability, amnesty will mobilize, as will others, to ensure that doesn't happen. And it also would have no legal bearing, because again, given the gravity of the crimes, you cannot amnesty crimes of this nature. In terms of coming back home, I think it's, for most people, it's pretty straightforward. This is where they have lived forever. This is their farmland. This is where they have grazed cattle. That's where their grandparents were born. It's where their great-great-grandparents were born. And so it's home. It's where it's where they have been for it's where they stretch back for generations and generations. And so it's still where they see as home, and still where they ultimately want to be able to go back to. And when you see the situation in the camps in Bangladesh, that's not somewhere that anyone would want to stay a day longer than absolutely necessary. They have been forced into this situation because of the horrific nature of the military's atrocities. But it's also why we see, I'm sure many of you have seen this in the news, that in the last month, we've had boats take off from parts of Myanmar heading for Malaysia and Indonesia and Thailand. And this is a phenomenon that has, existed for several years in this area, and in the past has been incredibly deadly. These boats are often not the greatest boats in the world, and they get lost at sea, or people run out of food and water during the journey. And so the nature of the human rights atrocities has led to a desperation in which people, take actions that are incredibly risky in order to get out of a situation in which their rights are abused on a daily basis. And so the key, again, is addressing those root causes such that they're, rather than being abused on a daily basis, they become part of the fabric of Myanmar society and have their rights respected, including the kind of core right to citizenship and to have a nationality.
So, operator, I think we have time for two more questions. Can we take the next question?
Our next question is with Jack Farrell. Please proceed with your question.
Yes, you mentioned rights of refugees being abused on a daily basis. I believe you meant in Bangladesh, and that is my question. What is the response of the Bangladesh authorities to this crisis generally, and in particular, has Bangladesh committed human rights crimes in this situation?
Matt.
So Bangladesh, I think anytime we're talking about Bangladesh and the refugee situation, it's both, you have to address both good and bad. I mean, they have opened their doors to, or at least allowed their doors to be opened to almost 700,000 people in a very short span of time. Bangladesh is obviously a very poor country, itself. And so there is an enormous burden from, from having this number of people cross in such a short period of time. There really isn't much recent, such incidents in which you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people crossing a border in the span of weeks during the first part of the violence. And knowing that it's not safe to return, it also being a huge number of people that they need to, house for the foreseeable future. So it's been incredibly taxing, for them, and that has to be acknowledged. And people certainly feel much safer, in Bangladesh and the camps than they did in Myanmar. There have been problems with the response. The Bangladeshi authorities have, at the most fundamental level, they do not consider the Rohingya to be refugees, and have not allowed them, have not granted them refugee status. They call them, displaced persons from Myanmar, which means nothing from a legal perspective. And the problem is that it then restricts the whole package of rights that come from being recognized as a refugee under international law. And as part of that, Bangladesh has has tried to historically, you know, restrict anything that would indicate that that these people are refugees. So, for example, there are a lot of the major humanitarian organizations that, you know, I see in conflicts around the world that don't have major operations in Bangladesh, like the Norwegian Refugee Council or the Danish DRC or IRC. I mean, like a lot of these really great organizations don't have historically operations and don't currently have major operations because the Bangladeshi authorities don't want to treat the Rohingya population as refugees. And so that has at times undermined the ability to respond as quickly and to the scale necessary to what's happening in Bangladesh. The other thing, you know, in terms of kind of specific human rights violations, we haven't yet worked on this, but there has been credible reporting from the BBC and others of the trafficking of particularly Rohingya girls in the refugee camps brought elsewhere within Bangladesh, it seems, as of now, for sex work. And I mean, this isn't, it's not a huge surprise. This happens in amongst a lot of, you know, very vulnerable and refugee populations around the world. But I do think, you know, we have concerns about kind of the lack of effective response to those issues and to, you know, again, kind of not compounding what is already a deeply traumatized population, given the human rights violations that have occurred, with more violations in, you know, in Bangladesh. And so there is a need, while acknowledging, the importance of Bangladesh having allowed so many people in and to have still, you know, on a daily basis be taking actions to ensure, you know, shelter and kind of basic food and all of that for a huge number of people, that there are problems with the response that need to be addressed. They need to be given refugee status because that's what they are. And there needs to be, you know, more work done to protect the population in Bangladesh from further exploitation and abuse.
Thank you. And operator, we'll take our final call for the evening, our final question for the evening.
There seem to be no further questions in the queue at this time.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, first of all, for giving us an hour of your time. We know all of you are incredibly busy, and it's evident through the questions and the really substantive nature of the questions that all of you are incredibly well-educated and informed and are really wrestling with these issues. And we urge you to continue to press your elected leaders to urge this the Trump administration to continue increasing humanitarian aid for the Rohingya refugees and displaced peoples, to press the U.S. government, to press Myanmar, to halt the atrocities being committed against the Rohingya and other ethnic and religious minorities. We thank you again for your generous donations and your support for Amnesty. We can definitely say that your support is what has allowed Matt to take multiple crisis missions over the past year to Myanmar, he and several other colleagues in his unit. And rest assured that we know that behind all of the work, the research, the investigations, the documentation, the advocacy and campaigning that we do day to day, we know that we are supported by a global human rights movement, both in the United States and around the world, and that we will not rest until these atrocities end. So thank you again for joining us. If you have any other questions, feel free to reach out to Francisco or me. We can both be reached through the Amnesty USA website, and we look forward to continuing to partner together on this. Thank you, operator.